You are listening to the Dan Patrick Show on Fox Sports Radio.
Common thinking is you can't win in the NFL without an elite quarterback. But when the Washington football team came into this offseason, we knew that they had some good pieces in place. I just didn't know if they were going to be able to get a quality quarterback, a Pro Bowl quality quarterback. And they ended up signing Ryan Fitzpatrick. Okay, Taylor Heinicke is filling in now because Fitzpatrick got hurt in week one, and Washington eked out the win last night. They overcame a late interception that he had. He led them to the game-winning field goal drive. And Heinicke might not look like much. He's listed at 6'1". He's out of Old Dominion. He's not afraid, I'll say that. But, you know, remember, this is a franchise that won a Super Bowl, a couple of Super Bowls with Mark Rippon, not exactly a Hall of Famer. It's a bit of a lofty goal, but at least Washington fans have reason to be excited that Heinicke can provide some stability there to complement an otherwise talented roster. It's one of those games. It's a game within a game. We saw this on Monday night with the Ravens and Raiders. It's like, I think I know what's going to happen. And then something else happens. And then you think you know what's going to happen. And then something else happened. Because if I'm Washington, I'm going, whew. If I'm the Giants, I'm like, we're in trouble. You got to capitalize. You can't kick field goals in the NFL and try to survive. You just can't. We saw that with the Patriots against the Dolphins. You can move the ball up and down the field. If you're not scoring touchdowns, you're going to let that other team stay in. And then you had the game-winning kick where you had offsides. Here is Joe Judge, the Giants head coach.
I'm not going to put this on Dex, and I don't want to put this on Dex. Okay, Dex is a good player. He's a strong piece of our locker room. He's a good teammate. He's fun to coach. He's productive for us as a player. I'm not going to put this on Dexter Lawrence. Okay, there's things we all have to do better as professionals. All right, but I'm not going to put this on any one player or one situation.
Okay, I mean, yeah, you can put blame on a lot of people, but you have a simple job. When you're over the center on a field goal, you see the ball. It's right in front of you. It's mind-blowing that you're offside in a situation like that. Like, do you really think you're going to block that field goal? And you see the ball snapped in front of you. If you're, you know, a defensive lineman, you may react off the offensive lineman. You see the ball right in front of you. But jumped offsides, got another chance, and ended up winning. Here is Ron Rivera talking about his quarterback before the last drive.
Specific to Taylor, what was your message to him there on that last two-minute drill?
Don't screw it up. No, it was all we had to do was get in the field goal position. You know, we felt we had a good shot at it, and you know, we got that opportunity.
That's Ron Rivera. McLovin, what's the poll question today?
Who has you more excited after last night, Daniel Jones or Taylor Heinicke?
Daniel Jones has talent. He's an athletic quarterback. He can beat you with his arm and his leg. And he could have easily won that game. You know, he had the holding call, or he would have had another touchdown. They have some wide receivers. They went out and got wide receivers. They drafted a wide receiver. You got Saquon Barkley, and I'm not sure what that means right now. Ingram didn't play. I always think that he's going to be something, and he's probably not going to be as good as what people thought he was going to be. You brought in Galladay. He didn't do anything last night. But you start to look at this team, and McLovin, if you bring up the Giants' schedule here, like, they're in trouble. You know, do you pick up Daniel Jones' fourth-year option? Do you re-sign Saquon Barkley? I know it's only two games, but if you start to look at their schedule – I mean, they got the Kansas City Chiefs coming up. They got the Cowboys coming up. You got that.
Yeah, so they host Atlanta next week. Then they go to New Orleans, to Dallas, host the Rams, host the Panthers, then at Kansas City.
Yeah,
oof. They got the Bucs in week 11 after a bye at Tampa Bay.
I mean, you wouldn't think at the beginning of the season, hey, this is going to be a 5-12 team. Because they might be worse. Who knows? I mean, that's not a great division, but we saw Philadelphia might be a little better than we thought. Washington is going to be there, I think, just because they got a great coach and the defense is good. Although that defense wasn't great last night, because you don't think of the Giants' offense as explosive. But they did hold him in check when it comes to kicking field goals. So Drew Brees will join us coming up, and then Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker on the Muhammad Ali documentary. Yes, Paulie?
Is Saquon Barkley not a great running back, or is he not used properly or other?
I don't know how healthy he is. And you're going to limit his touches because he's coming back from knee surgery. You know, we liken him to Barry Sanders. He's not the home run hitter that Barry Sanders was. Like, he had 8 carries and 41 yards, but he had 1 carry for 41 yards. So the rest of them were zero. Barry Sanders might give you +1, +1, -2, 62 yards, those kind of things. And I still think Barry Sanders wasn't used correctly in Detroit, but that's a story for another day. Saquon is not that kind of player. No, nobody's like Barry Sanders. But I just think he started out great. I want to use him out of the backfield. I don't know if – I wouldn't re-sign him. I don't want to re-sign a running back. But you might look at this and go, God, we drafted him so high. And he's got charisma. He looks good on camera. He's got star power. It's just I don't want to tie up that kind of money. Yeah, McLovin.
As an ACL survivor, he's 1 year off ACL as a running back. That's got to be. I mean, he played 2 games in 4 days, like they said. That.
Wait, did you lump yourself in as an ACL
survivor?
No,
I was actually asking you as an ACL survivor. No way he can be like the same explosive
like
guy.
We don't have a therapy group for ACL survivors.
Yeah, I'm actually, knock on wood, never had an ACL, but you've had like 11, so I figured.
They finally put something in this last time. They gave me a new knee. They kept taking things out. I'm like, that's not good.
Actually, did you even have an ACL for a period of your life? I feel like you were just.
I don't know. I know I had a meniscus tear for about 7 years. It was like, all right, we'll just somehow survive. But, yeah, I don't know what the Giants are going to do. You know, Dave Gettleman, their GM, is he going to survive? Probably not. It feels like they like Joe Judge. I mean, he's the rah-rah guy. Maybe he is the right guy. To be fair to him, he's just starting his career. But you start to look at the Giants and, you know, they're going to have a few losses here. They might have double-digit losses this year. Yeah, Paul.
And it seems like every team's direction is based on this quarterback cap situation. You know, let's say the Giants are, 6-11? That's pretty bad. Yeah. But let's say Daniel Jones has a nice season and shows promise. They're still in a position where they either have to give him a whole bunch of money or cut him. The old Trubisky thing or the Mariota thing. There is no middle room anymore.
I know. Well, that's because these agents and general managers have made it that way. That Daniel Jones is going to come up and everybody's going to go, you're going to pay him $40 million? I got to give you, how about 20? How about 25? You know, but there's no middle ground. And as a result, then you might have Daniel Jones have to kind of hit the reset button with another team.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Dan Patrick Show weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
NBC Sunday Night Football, Notre Dame analyst, Super Bowl MVP, Drew Brees set to join us on the program. And Drew will be on the call. Notre Dame hosting his alma mater, the Boilermakers of Purdue, this Saturday. That's at 2:30 Eastern. And then Football Night in America, he'll be on that. Ahead of the Chiefs, Ravens, all on NBC and Peacock. And Drew Brees joins us. How's the weather in South Bend, Indiana?
I'm actually driving. I just passed Kokomo, Indiana. I'm on Highway 31 North, headed up to South Bend right now.
Did Notre Dame recruit you?
No, they didn't.
Sounds like you're still holding a grudge there.
No. No grudges. I'm a Texas kid, so I wanted to go to the Texas schools. That was back in the old Southwest Conference days. You remember those days?
Yeah, oh yeah, I do. Did the Texas schools recruit you?
No, they didn't. both my parents went to Texas A&M, so I wanted to be an Aggie. Even though the reputation for the Aggies back then with quarterbacks it's where quarterbacks go to die. The quarterback graveyard. It was running back and linebacker you. But still, I love the tradition. I wanted to be an Aggie.
Oh. How much did that hurt that all of a sudden you don't hear from them?
ironically, my left tackle in high school was offered by A&M as like a sophomore. He was a phenom. His name was Seth McKinney. His older brother, Steve McKinney, was a lineman there at the time. It ended up playing in the league for a long time. Both those guys did. And so I went on an unofficial visit to A&M my senior year, and Seth's parents were pretty influential with A&M. His dad was the chancellor at A&M, and so they were really pushing the Aggies to recruit me. And so I think it was just out of respect for them that the Aggies kind of made it seem like they were a little bit interested. And so they, when I was on this unofficial visit, they scheduled an official visit for me in January. And so a week before the official visit, I call because I haven't heard a peep from A&M. I said, "Hey, am I still coming on this visit?" And they said, "Oh yeah, we'll call you right back." and they never called back. So, it makes for a good story now, you know. But things probably would have been quite different had I gone to A&M and not the spread offense at Purdue.
When did it hit you that you're not playing football any longer?
It's not like you just wake up one day and say, "Hey, I think I'm going to retire." I mean, that's a process. Especially as I got, later in my career, I knew that I was closer to the end than the beginning. And so you begin to think about how that's going to transpire and, the feelings and emotions that go along with that.
But so like the weekend, with no football, but you're covering it. But do you wake up and you're like, "Oh God, I'm not playing," or I'm not preparing? Whereas, it was part of your life for decades.
Yeah. It's a grind. preparing to go play a game is a grind. And now it provides a weekly routine and it provides habits that I think really make you feel good, make you feel like you're going out and earning what you're going to get on Sundays. And so there's definitely something to that. But honestly, what fills that void for me now is coaching my kids and watching my kids play and still staying in tune with the game, obviously with broadcasting and with some of the things I'm doing with NBC. So there's ways that I'm filling that void.
Toughest thing to get used to as a member of the media?
I don't really consider myself a member of the media, even though I guess technically I am. I try to approach it the same way I did as a player. I still prepare very much the same way in the way that I'm watching film and what I'm looking for, and what then I try to communicate to the fans. So maybe I'm just taking a different approach to it.
We had a conversation yesterday, and we were wondering what you would say to this. Are you? Do you think you're better than Tom Brady?
That's not fair. Let me just say it like this. You can't match up with the championships, right? Just stop the conversation right there. The guy's won seven championships. And you can go to each one, and it's very unique that my career has coincided almost exactly with his. He came out a year before me from Michigan. We played against each other in college, but certainly he's always been a guy that I've watched, respected, admired, pull up their game tape, watch them. So many elements of his preparation and his process in getting ready to play that I feel like I know quite a bit about. So for that reason, so much respect and admiration. I'll be honest, I think each quarterback, and you could say this about Peyton Manning, you could say this about the Aaron Rodgers, you can say this about the guys that came before us, like the Dan Marinos and the Elways and kind of that era. Each era of football kind of especially with quarterbacks, I think kind of stands alone. I don't think it's fair to compare this era of quarterback with the eras that came before us, just because there's differences in the rules, there's differences in the environment, just all those things. There are things that I look at and say, you know, Tom Brady does this better than anybody that I've ever seen. I could say that about Peyton Manning. I could say that about Aaron Rodgers. I could say that about myself. There's things that I think that I did better than anybody. So that's the way I look at it, is there's elements of everyone's game that probably set them apart from everybody else.
Yeah, because he has the resume, but the competitor in you still would feel like, I mean, you didn't get to, you know, on the doorstep of the Hall of Fame without having belief in yourself. You know, if somebody said, hey, are you better than Bob Costas? At certain things I am. He's got the resume. He's got all of the sports Emmys. But in my mind, I feel like, hey, I can do things that he can't do, and vice versa.
Exactly. So, there's this competitive edge that exists with guys when you're in the moment, when you're playing the game, right? Like, I always felt like, especially maybe with quarterbacks in the NFL, that we would all have even closer relationships if it wasn't for the game. It is just so competitive, and we want to beat each other. You know, we want to be better than that other guy. You know, and I think we recognize the areas where someone might be better than us. You know, like, I can turn on the film and say, man, I recognize where Brady's better than me, or where Rodgers is, or Peyton, or, you know, one of these guys. And yet, so what do I have to do to get an edge on them, right? And obviously we're not playing against each other in a game, but at the same time we are. Because my performance has to be better than his performance in order for us to win this game, right? So, So yeah, that's how you develop an edge. I mean, that's how you develop your strategy for how you're going to need to approach the game or approach your performance in order to be better.
Talking to Drew Brees, his alma mater is playing Notre Dame coming up this Saturday at 7:30 Eastern. And, of course, Football Night in America, it's 7 Eastern on Sunday. That'll be the Chiefs and the Ravens. Last time you spoke to Jameis Winston was when?
I talked to him after the game.
Did you talk to him before the game?
We'll text. You know, I'm in touch with him and Taysom quite a bit. Throughout training camp, the preseason, and during the season.
Are you an unofficial assistant coach?
I will say this. I did have the game plan for the game in my hand.
Wait, did you write it up? Did you?
No.
Did you? Okay, okay. The Saints gave it to you.
Yeah, the Saints gave it to me.
How's Notre Dame looking, by the way?
You know what? They're finding ways to win. I'll say that. You know, they open up the season down at Florida State, which, you know, fans are back, hostile environment. Obviously, Florida State was geeked up for that game. You know, Notre Dame goes up by, what was it, 18 points in the fourth quarter, and then really allows Florida State to get back in that game and tie it. And then it goes to overtime, and Notre Dame finds a way to win. That game really should have been much more convincing for Notre Dame. They just let them back in. They played Toledo at home this last weekend, and honestly, Toledo should have beat them.
Yeah.
Toledo outplayed them.
Yeah. I agree.
But listen, what do good teams do? They find a way to win, even if they're not playing their best football. I'd say this about Notre Dame. It's a different team than it was last year. They lost a lot of – I mean, listen, they had like 9 guys drafted, right? So four out of their 5 offensive linemen, a couple key defensive starters. So to me, they're still trying to find their identity on both sides of the ball, both offensively and defensively. You know, they get Jack Cohn, a graduate transfer from Wisconsin. He's done a great job for them. They've got this young, true freshman quarterback in Tyler Buchner, who came in against Toledo and was electric in what he was able to do. Defensively, they have a new defensive coordinator, Marcus Freeman, who is bringing in this aggressive style of defense. He's a defensive coordinator at Cincinnati prior to this. So you're seeing a lot more variation in what they're doing, pressure, et cetera. But they just haven't quite found their identity yet. And I think a lot of it's just based on, hey, where do our strengths lie? You know, what's our personnel look like? And then how are we going to develop the system around that?
How's the city of New Orleans after Hurricane Ida?
It's on the rebound, as New Orleans always finds a way to do. It's so resilient, and people band together and just work to come back. You know, this was such a sudden deal. You know, the way that Ida just picked up in force and hit New Orleans and really all of South Louisiana. And I think the major issue was the power outages. You know, and just what that causes. You know, schools. In many cases, kids haven't gone back to school. You know, a lot of families have been displaced. That's the college, high school, you know, all the way down. You know, the New Orleans Saints are in Dallas right now, practicing, I think, for another week or two, and have been since the storm. So just so many ramifications. I know that power line workers are just working around the clock, sleeping in their cars down in South Louisiana to try to restore power. You know, we're working with a bunch of organizations like Convoy of Hope and Second Harvest Food Bank and others to get a lot of these people food, resources, the things they need in order to restore power so that we get families back in their homes and schools back going again. And so it's just the challenges that come along with that.
Here's a little tip. If your alma mater beats Notre Dame, don't jump up and say we won, okay?
Yeah, they're trying to coach the we out of my lingo when it comes to Purdue and the Saints, you know?
Yeah. You can't say we. Can't.
Yeah, that's hard. That's hard.
No cheering. No cheering in the press box, all right?
Listen, you know what I found myself? I mean, even last week, I find myself cheering for, like, really just good, sound football. And off, you know, some offensive fireworks. And I like seeing, you know, good schemes on offense, good concepts, good execution. So I find myself cheering for whoever's on offense.
Safe travels. We'll be watching on Saturday night. And great to catch up with you again, Drew.
Bye, Dan. You too. Thank you.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
He's Mike Harmon. I'm Dan Byer. We have a brand new fantasy football podcast called I Want Your Flex. Twice a week, every Tuesday and Friday, we come up with new episodes to not only look back at what happened, what you need to do at that minute, and also look ahead of what's coming up in the fantasy football world.
That's right, Dan. Every week, we're going to scour the waiver wire to find the pickups to turbo boost your fantasy lineup. Sits, starts, fantasy football players' rankings to get you ready to dominate the competition.
Listen to I Want Your Flex with Mike Harmon and me, Dan Byer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Ken Burns is a great documentary filmmaker. I don't know how I'm going to make the segue, but I'm going to
put
do
you in a really
dad.
Bad spot there.
Again. I know. You did. But he did Vietnam War. He did the history of baseball. He did the Civil War. And he has a new documentary that premieres. It's September 19th through the 22nd on PBS. And it's a four-part film by Ken Burns, his oldest daughter, Sarah, and her husband, David McMahon. And Ken Burns, kind enough to join us on the program. When did Muhammad Ali become a hero?
I think he was a hero almost from the beginning. That kind of pan-world heroism happens towards the end as we let go of the memories of some of the divisive aspects. But he's at the beginning, he's saying, I'm pretty as a girl, I'm black, I'm beautiful. He is providing many people in this country with phrases and purchase for ideas that they didn't have. We made a film on Jackie Robinson. He redefined black manhood, black masculinity. Muhammad Ali came along and redefined it in a different way. Athletes weren't supposed to speak that way. They weren't supposed to brag. And certainly black athletes weren't supposed to do that. And he did it anyway. And just brought him into so many people's hearts if he turned off some other people. And then he joins a separatist religious sect, which turns off another group of people. And then strike three, he refuses to induction into the United States Army. And so we think of him as divisive. He's also quite provocative about how he treats his opponents. Joe Frazier, for example, Todd Boyd, the scholar, says in our film, you know, he uses the language that a white racist would use about a black man to describe his opponent, two black men. And it's inexcusable. And yet emerging out of it is a person always with a sort of a joie de vivre, a kind of great sense of humor, a sense of natural promoting in a very American sense, and a kind of beauty. I mean, he's the greatest athlete of the 20th century, maybe of all time. He's won the championship three times, even though he lost 3.5 years at the height of his power because of his religious beliefs. This is a black man saying, I won't fight in the Vietnam War for religious reasons. An American can only hear, black man doesn't want to go. He's giving us the middle finger. This is a political gesture. So even though the prosecutors are suggesting a more lenient sentence, the judge sends him to the maximum, 5 years. And when he's exonerated, he begins a comeback. He begins a climb that begins with some wins, but most significantly in the fight of the century in 71 against Joe Frazier, a loss, which he takes very well. He's behind on points. He goes out in the last round. He's knocked down. He gets back up again. He's very soft-spoken and speaks about the larger sense of being a role model, even in loss. And from then on, it's just Robert Lipsight in our film says, Joe Frazier won the fight, but Muhammad Ali won America. And I think from that moment on, it just goes exponentially. So that when he dies, not too long ago, as you know, 2016, he dies the most beloved person on the planet, which has got to tell you something.
I couldn't help but notice this, Ken, when I'm watching this, that it's almost like he was able to listen to what people say about you after you die. Because once Muhammad Ali, like, he was awake for his funeral. Because
yes, he was.
People were, they were comfortable talking about Ali as if he was passed because he couldn't speak. Yeah. And it just dawned on me that what that must have been like for Ali to listen. I mean, he probably loved it because
they were still talking.
Yeah, they were saying all these nice things. I was also curious about his ring bravado, and it brought about images of maybe wrestling. Like, wrestlers were over the top and gregarious. And I wondered, because we didn't have that. Boxers weren't like that. Athletes weren't like that. Like, where did that come from?
Well, you know, David Remnick, the writer and biographer, early biographer of Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, also talked about one of the great inspirational moments. He's in Las Vegas for a fight, but he goes and he sees Gorgeous George, who was the villain in wrestling, who permed up his hair and was preening and whatever and wearing this outlandish stuff and kind of androgynous at times. And he understood that it didn't matter. People paid to see him and paid to hate him. And that's what he said, boo, hiss, throw peanuts, but whatever you do, pay to get in. And I think he understood a fundamental aspect of American hype, of P.T. Barnumism, is it didn't really matter, and that he could still be provocative. May I just admit, as I should have at the start, this is a film directed by my daughter Sarah Burns and David McMahon, her husband. We've been collaborating together on a lot of things, as well as me. But it's also to acknowledge there are lots of documentaries on Muhammad Ali, and there are several really good documentaries on Muhammad Ali, really, really good. And we don't mean to suggest that they are not. We wanted to do something comprehensive, from boyhood, birth and boyhood in segregated Jim Crow Louisville to death by Parkinson's in 2016, and not just follow the fights and not just pay lip service to the Nation of Islam, but understand him as being a human being on a very legitimate and genuine spiritual quest. And also the personal stuff and the family and the biography and the wives and the children. And so this is as, I think, as comprehensive as you can get in terms of the arc of the life of one of the most extraordinary Americans who's ever lived.
It's a 4-part film by Ken and his daughter and her husband, and it premieres September 19th through the 22nd on PBS. How do you find the sweet spot for a documentary?
You know, you would presume that this is an additive process, you know, like you're building a house. it's subtractive, Dan. You know, we collect, you know, this is 8 hours long. We've got 400 or 500 hours of material, right? And then you're distilling it, to use a Louisville, Kentucky term. You're distilling it down to a kind of essence. And so our cutting room floor is not filled with bad stuff. It's filled with really, really good stuff that you look at and go, Burns, you've lost your mind. Why isn't that in there? And you go, well, it was there for 6 months, but it seemed to destabilize that. So our process is always being open. You know, it's not a set research period followed by a writing period that produces a script that informs the shooting and editing, boom, done. We never stop researching, and we found stuff no one has ever put forward before, because we're with PBS, we spent 7 years. No suit is saying, I need this by the summer.
How often do people stop you on the street and say, I got a great idea for a documentary?
Every day.
What's the strangest suggestion?
Well, what one person wanted to be, they said, here, I'm giving you, they mailed this in, I'm giving you the 4 volumes of my grandfather's memoir of his Civil War years, although I'd done the Civil War. Turns out he never left Maine. But they, you know, self-published this memoir.
Okay.
So I finally, after about 10 years, I did it up. The number one thing is railroads. The number two thing is labor. The next thing is education. And then they're just, you know, you got to do this. And they're all right. And I'm working on 7 films right now, because I am 68 years old. And I know if I were given 1,000 years to live, which I will not, I would not run out of topics in American history. And so I've got 4 different producers. Team, Sarah and Dave are one of them, and we're just working on as many as we can in different stages of undress, and because I'm greedy for that experience of finding the sweet spot. I mean, I want to put my head on the pillow at the end of the day and say, God, I made at least one of them better.
Give me the sports documentary that hasn't been done but should be.
That's a really good question. I tried in baseball. I did an update the 10th inning. I promised people that if the Cubs won the World Series, I would do an 11th inning. And I am
You
so,
thought you were safe, Ken.
I thought I was so safe. George Will said, well, they're having a bad century. And it turned out that's all it was a bad century and a decade. So I've got to do that at some point. There's a lot of nice new stuff about it, but I got to just find the bandwidth to do that. You know, I love baseball. It's the greatest sport ever invented. I love football a lot. And I'd like to see something done, I guess in football, that isn't just, you know, the dramas of the reality TV nature of the behind the scenes. I don't know what that is right now, but nothing compares to baseball. And it's funny, I'm not a boxing fan. I made 2 boxing films. They total, you know, 12 hours of time on Jack Johnson 4 and on this one 8. But it's only because these two men were so transcendent. I mean, a lot of the sports writers who I've done lots of interviews with, and we've got 3 of the very best writers, Lipsyte, Dave Kindred, and Jerry Eisenberg in the film, who were Cubs growing up with Muhammad Ali and love him and care about him and remember each bad punch. But, you know, I would ask each one and no one's answered. I said, who's the heavyweight champion right now? It doesn't matter. After Muhammad Ali, you got a little dribble of Mike Tyson. And then, you know what? It does not matter until somebody else like him comes along. And hate to give away the plot, no one like Muhammad Ali is ever coming along again.
Do you need coffee or a nap?
I don't drink coffee because it's no problem getting me out of bed. What I need is, you know, the conk on the head at the end of the day, because, you know, it just to shut the thing up.
Thank you, Ken. Well done, as always.
Thank you. Great to be with you.